Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Inside Segment. I'm Harold Fisher.
We need your ideas. We need your creativity, and we need to draw on the skills of all of our people. You know, 30% of African-American STEM professionals graduate from an HBCU, and they're the talent that our country needs.
That's Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin yesterday here at Howard University helping to announce a $90 million military contract with the Air Force and the university. It's a major first for Howard University and the Department of Defense, just one of several issues we're going to discuss tonight with Howard University President Dr. Wayne Frederick. Lines are open. Give us a call if you have a comment or a question at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisher, WHUR, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Happy New Year, Dr. Frederick.
Happy New Year.
Good to see you. It's been a minute.
Same here. The pandemic has disrupted us in more ways than one.
Yeah, without a doubt. But it is good to put some eyes on you, and we'll talk about that a bit. But first, let's talk about yesterday's, I think, big news is an understatement. Huge news. $90 million Department of Defense contract through the Air Force to Howard University. Explain to us not only what it is, but what it means to the university. This is really an historic event.
Yeah, it certainly is. You know, the Department of Defense has these centers, which are known as university-affiliated research centers. They've had them for a few decades. And the way these work, they basically engage specific universities via a research contract in order to have them perform research around a particular issue. And that research is usually applied around something that is going to help advance some part of their work, whether it's technology, etc. Everyone isn't always clear as to what the specifics of that research is. As you can imagine, that those are military secrets to some extent. The uniqueness about this is that, unlike a regular research grant in which a faculty member may have an interest in an area and have a theory and therefore apply for a grant and work on, you know, an idea that they have, basically the Department of Defense and the Air Force, they have a particular area that they want to work on. And in this case, it's around developing autonomous tactical ways of engaging with the enemy. And so whether that's using artificial intelligence or machine learning algorithms, etc. And they come to you and say, listen, you know, we want you to work on these things. What's unique about this one as well is that it includes the ability to work with a pipeline of getting more diverse talent into STEM. That's, again, in the national security's best interest, actually, to have more diverse personnel working on these issues. And also it helps us strengthen our research apparatus as well, so that there's even more that we can do apart from what we're doing in terms of working with the Department of Defense, but just as an institution. This was also unusual because this one was actually competed. The other UARCs were awarded to universities based on their competence and their abilities in specific areas. This one, we actually had to compete for it. So that was unique. And it was directed at HBCUs. So we have a consortium that we formed with 8 other institutions, all HBCUs. And so that this really benefits the larger ecosystem as well. So it's certainly a historic research contract for Howard to be awarded. It says a lot about what we've been doing with respect to building our infrastructure to be able to compete for something like this successfully. But just as importantly, it says a lot about our faculty and who they are, their capabilities, et cetera. And so these things don't happen overnight. I think over the past decade that I've been in this seat, research has been a focus, and building that has been a very important focus. And I think that we are on a moment here where we really are going to be in a very different realm of being able to compete as well as being able to produce.
What will this contract do? You speak about infrastructure. First of all, for the university, does that mean a new building? You say a center that brings to mind a completely new kind of place on campus?
Yeah, so we already have buildings that we're building, and we anticipate that in one of those buildings that we've already decided to build, that we'll be able to place a center. Obviously, temporarily, we'll house them somewhere else until the building is built. This actually will support more the actual work and activity, computing, the activity that the researchers are going to need in order to use the advanced technologies around AI, developing those technologies, et cetera. This will support students, PhD students, for instance, doctoral students in computer science, who are pursuing that and want to do research in this area. It'll be able to support them. It'll be able to support attending conferences and people being able to learn new ideas, advanced new technologies, et cetera. So there's a lot of support that this $90 million over the 5 years would give us. And as I said before, that support will also be shared with 8 other institutions as well. You know, obviously, we're the lead. So there's a lot of infrastructure around the actual research activity, learning the technology, passing that information on to others, developing new ideas about the technology, working with the Air Force on very, very sophisticated types of research and development of that autonomy, autonomous types of activity that they want to see within the Air Force and the Space Force, for that matter. So it really puts us on the cutting edge, and the money will go towards developing and conducting that research, which, as you can imagine as well, is also extremely expensive when you're talking about potentially having major, you know, jets that fly on their own and could be part of a fleet with manned aircrafts as well. And so this is very, very cutting edge. And I think, again, is going to expose the entire campus to a variety of things. Yesterday, as was mentioned, the ethics of as you develop AI, how does that treat or engage with diverse populations? Does that look at diverse populations differently? We've seen the research already on facial recognition and those types of things. So all of those are things that we get an opportunity to weigh in on, and that's why having a diverse group of researchers working on these activities only makes it better technology.
Yeah, to your point, as it relates to facial recognition, the knock on it since its early development is that it does not work well with people of color.
Yeah.
And that was one of the and has been when attempting to, you know, identify, you know, potential, you know, terror suspects, you know, even for computers, they all look alike. Yeah. And so this, I do understand, you know, at least in one lane of this, how the consortium, this group of HBCUs led by Howard University, could really kind of change the game. Do you think that, you mentioned PhD and graduate school students, but there's already ROTC here. So would that also be the civilian students as well as ROTC?
That's correct. Again, if you look at the military advances that they've had, it is that cooperation with our universities that has helped the university with a lot of the things that they have been able to advance over the years. And so having an ROTC program on campus, and specifically cadets from the U.S. Air Force, again, I think really accelerates their learning and their ability to go into commissioning and join the Air Force with a very different experience. I mean, a young lady who spoke yesterday, Cadet White, she's a classic example. She's a sophomore in architecture. She gets to do research in the UOC looking at, you know, autonomous systems and probably looking at it from a different perspective. you know, about how you navigate through buildings, as an example. I mean, there's so much that she could potentially learn and bring that when she gets commissioned at the end of, you know, her tenure here at Howard and graduates, she becomes a very attractive person for the U.S. Air Force in a very different way, and can get some special assignments that could really set her apart, as an example. So the benefit for the students is incredible. Same thing with students who may go into the civilian world. Students who've worked in this area of research will see things that others haven't seen. And when they compete for jobs, they are absolutely going to be very competitive, if not more competitive than some of their peers.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking to Howard University President Dr. Wayne Frederick about all things Howard University. If you have a comment or a question for the president, give us a call. This contract is for 5 years, but because this is such a new thing for Howard University, what is your hope after the 5 year contract is over? Because, at least from my perspective, this is another reason to put Howard University on the map. Okay, we've got college, you know, College of Dentistry, you know, College of Medicine, School of Business, you know, School of Communications, Fine Arts, you know, and I'm just picking these things out of the air that for decades, that, you know, outsiders who know nothing about the HBCUs, but they hear Howard University, you think about those things. Is this just the first step to expanding the kind of contractual or military relationship that the university has?
Yeah, absolutely. We have had research contracts in the past with the military and participated, but those are obviously have been much smaller contracts and not a university-affiliated research center. The university-affiliated research center gives us the opportunity. If you think of how complex this research is and however evolving it's going to be, the five-year contract is just the beginning. It's how we have to see that. And we have to make sure we perform well, first and foremost, and then just as importantly, that we're able to renew the contract and even expand it, to your point. I mean, when we look at what we have on this campus in terms of the quality of our faculty, ethics as one aspect of AI, I mean, bringing those members in, you mentioned medicine. We were just talking about something like facial recognition. We have a dermatology department that in many ways have probably graduated more black dermatologists than anywhere else in the country. When you put our med school together and our residency training program in dermatology alone, that's probably been responsible for well over 50% of the black dentists in this country. I mean, black dermatologists in this country. And so when you put that together with something like a facial recognition, you have a different type of asset that we bring because of the complexity of who we are, having a dermatology residency at an HBCU, the only one in the country. So again, there's so many different aspects that this will bring that not only the Department of Defense, but this also opens up to other agencies, right, that will start looking at us differently, right? You look at, for instance, the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
I was about to say that,
right?
Yeah.
You start talking about things like, you know, food security, et cetera. I mean, again, looking at the urban environment, looking at black farmers. I mean, there's so much that we have to contribute, we think, to making the government that much stronger. And we have to always remember that we're the only federally chartered HBCU, signed into existence on March 2nd, 1867, by the 17th President of the United States. So we also have had a unique birth in terms of the federal government's role. We are one of two non-military institutions that is in the federal appropriation budget. So again, this relationship with the government is now significantly enhanced by this UARC, and I think represents an opportunity going forward.
That's amazing. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking to Howard University President Dr. Wayne Frederick about all things Howard University. Lot to talk to. First time that the president has been with us since the height of the pandemic. We're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about this partnership that the university has entered into regarding prostate cancer research, a very, very big deal. A lot to talk about with Dr. Frederick, but stay with us. We're going to take a break, but don't forget you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insight segment via podcast on WHUR.com, or you can download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM channel 141 and 96.3 HD2. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm. That's on WHUR. We'll be back in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're talking all things Howard University with President Dr. Wayne Frederick. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dr. Frederick, before the break, I wanted to kind of shift gears. We were talking about medicine and health, and about a week or so ago, there was an announcement about the university partnering with the American Cancer Society for prostate research. I would argue if it weren't for the contract announcement yesterday, that really would have been the big news, not only of this conversation, but just for Howard University going into 2023. Explain this research partnership.
Yeah, sure. I think first thing I need to say is, for the sake of full disclosure, I'm on the American Cancer Society Board of Directors. And American Cancer Society has a very significant role to play in cancer outcomes in the United States. One of the things they do is to put out cancer facts and figures. And the most recent edition of that showed a significant improvement in terms of the outcomes of Americans with cancers, with almost all kinds of cancer. However, there is still a gap and a disparity in the outcomes between African Americans in particular and the rest of the population. That gap was particularly significant in patients with prostate cancer, which accounts for the second largest number of deaths in men, with lung cancer being number one. And so when you look at those outcomes, the concern here is, remember a few years ago, the U.S. Prevention Task Force puts out recommendations, and the recommendation at that time was we probably were over-treating some prostate cancers, probably detecting some cancers very early when they would not cause a problem, et cetera. And so some of the recommendations were around about how you use the digital rectal exam, the prostate-specific antigen, the PSA testing, et cetera. That evolved, and what we are now concerned about is that gap with African-American men in particular has actually widened, and their outcomes are worse. And so there is a concern that maybe that recommendation may not have been the right thing for African-American men in particular. I can't make a definitive statement about that, but the whole idea of this research, this impact collaboration with the American Cancer Society, is to investigate that, to try to find what are the right things that we should be doing and help the U.S. Preventive Task Force and the medical community make the right recommendations for African Americans, and more importantly, to try to bring down the incidence and mortality from prostate cancer in our African American brothers. And it's a very critical time for us to do it. The data suggests that it's worsening, it's not getting better, and so we have to be very aggressive about it. So we're very happy to partner with the American Cancer Society on this.
What will the university be doing specifically? Again, is this something that the cancer center or the hospital obviously will probably be involved in? Is this, what kind of research? What's the process?
Yeah, we're going to do a multitude of things. You know, we're going to look at population studies. We're going to try to enroll a certain number of men in a database study where you can track them over time and see how often they get prostate cancer, et cetera. And somebody like myself, when I look at my family situation, my stepfather died from prostate cancer last year. My youngest brother, who is his biological son, it would be good to see him enter a study like this. He's in his 40s, go through the screening, you know, see what happens. It would be great to have people like himself, for instance, in that database. I myself lost my dad a month shy of my third birthday, not from prostate cancer, but lost him. And so it would be interesting to see what my screening looks like so that my 18-year-old son now has, you know, some indication of what to expect. So some of this research may have some short-term implications, but we're also looking at the long game. You know, how do we collect enough data on enough men? How do we look at their genetic makeup when they do get their PSA done? Can we collect tissue when they get their biopsies done and look for mutations that might be unique in black men that may be causing a more aggressive type of prostate cancer? And we're recognizing that even when they're diagnosed, they seem to have more advanced disease develop over time. And so that may have some type of a genetic origin. So part of this is to really get our arms around getting enough. And when you look at clinical trials in general and you look at other databases, we just don't have enough African-American men involved, to be quite honest, to be drawing hard conclusions and making recommendations.
So now's your chance to make the pitch for black men to enter clinical trials and research and
yeah,
the like.
Well, I'll tell you, my primary pitch is actually for black families to enter. I think sometimes when we talk about clinical trials, we make it a very individual decision. And I think as a community, we have to make a pivot. If you look at where black men get most of their health care that are part of family units, they do so where women kind of get their care, and women tend to decide a lot of that. That's one thing. I think the second thing is when you have, you know, offspring like myself, I have an 18-year-old son, a 16-year-old daughter, we have a responsibility to make sure that we're passing on as much information to them about what their risks are, right? And what are the concerns that they might have, right? So my father-in-law, for instance, has, you know, had a prostate issue that he has had addressed. It was not cancerous. But again, that information, it would be helpful to have more information about that so that when my son is making a screening decision, he's not just using his age, you know, the fact that his ethnicity, but then he's using a really strong family history that's developed in the database that he could say, well, my dad started his screenings at this age, his PSA didn't go high until this time when he had his biopsy, this was the information, and same thing he should have from his grandfather as well, right? And so those are the types of things, Hal, that we want to make sure that we can bring to the forefront, that we can be sharing. So I really want people to think of the participation as a family thing, because I think the more we start thinking about that as a community, the more we recognize the responsibility is not just solely on this one person to participate, but they really are doing it for the larger community.
We are in January, this is 2023, this is the month of the third anniversary of the first U.S. COVID cases. Hard to believe that it's literally been 3 years. And I'm sure you've had a chance or have taken an opportunity to kind of reflect on the impact that this has had on the university, on the student body, the faculty, the staff, you and your family. In the past, you know, 3 years, when you think back over what this pandemic has done, what are the things that come to mind?
You know, I'll first start at home. You know, I think the ability to bring me closer, you know, to my family, my unit at home, I think is one thing I would mention, and I would say both my family and friends. Mm-hmm. You know, we started at my house at least once a week. I would cook with my kids and, you know, give my wife a much deserved break. And while we probably made a hell of a mess, it created opportunities for conversations. You know, we sat around the dining table more regularly. We were, you know, almost forced just by the mere nature of being in that space all the time with one another, you know, to have conversations and to engage in a different way, you know, and I think it was important. So while there were things lost in terms of my kids, you know, being able to interact with their broader social circle and be in school, et cetera, I look at them on the other side of this, and they've grown immensely. You know, I think that the challenge, I was always optimistic in the middle of the storm that they would grow and others around them would. So I would say that's the first thing. The second thing I would say is our community, I think, really did two things. We demonstrated the resilience and grit that we've had to develop as a result of the societal systemic racism that does exist, that cannot be denied. But we also, I think, were able to educate others about that. One of my favorite things that I will always remember from this is having a patient over 100 years old come to our vaccine center and be vaccinated by a nursing student. I mean, just think about, you know, their difference in age was 82 years plus. What she experienced over that time, what she has seen America be, and for that matter, not be, mm-hmm. and to be able to come to Howard University and have somebody who looks like her, as she looked some 80-something years ago, give her a vaccine, I think it says a lot about, you know, who we were as a community. And then the third thing is, I think, especially for the university, the fact that every corner of this university rallied to assist in some way, shape, or form, rallied to help the students. So whether it's faculty going online and teaching, you know, whether it's the personnel in the hospital providing testing and vaccination, you know, for others, whether it's the athletic teams doing more and more community work. The university community really rallied around each other. And I've spoken about that from the time I sat in my presidency, that, you know, our ability to practice self-love in the best way. And that is really about enhancing the dignity of others. I believe universities in general should be here to amplify other people's humanity. And I think Howard epitomizes that. And it did during the pandemic, you know. So I would say those are the things that, you know, I took away from it. Obviously, there's a lot of negative things that have occurred in terms of the economy, people's finances, people losing loved ones. There's a lot. But, you know, I would say I try to focus on the three things that really represented kind of, you know, where our North Star should be.
Mm-hmm. How do you think the university, coming out of the worst of the pandemic, because let's be clear, you know, the COVID is still with us. You can debate whether or not it's so-called a pandemic, but it is with us, and it's going to be with us for a while. But how do you think the university has changed? How have students changed, faculty, and even more broadly, you know, HBCUs, how have they changed coming out of the worst of this?
Yeah. You know, I think our ability to be self-reliant is one of the things I think we would come out of this with. The fact that we were able, with the general support of Thermo Fisher, but to have our testing internal, we didn't have to send samples out. We were doing that testing right here. It demonstrated that as a comprehensive research university, in the middle of a crisis, we had the ability to stand something like that up and to be able to help each other and not have to depend on sending a sample to another university or, you know, doing something of that nature. I think that was very important for us to recognize our ability to be self-reliant. I think our ability to stretch our limits as well, right, to go beyond who we are today. So when you look at how quickly faculty were able to stand up online classes, you know, I think it changed the university. Our ability to offer, you know, online education has expanded tremendously as a result, and we're seeing that already. So now we have new programs in social work, et cetera, where we're expanding our online offerings as a result, and the manner in which we give that education is going to be changed and it's going to be important. And I'd say the last thing is, when you look overall at, you know, what we do on a day-to-day basis and how we do it and the spaces in which we do it, I think everybody has a greater appreciation for the fragility of this existence. While I think our mortality is well-defined, I think sometimes we can get so caught up in the day-to-day, you know, and stepping on each other as a means to, you know, get to an end that, you know, sometimes I think we need to recognize, you know, the humanity of what we're doing and why we're existing in the first place. And I think A lot of members of our community appreciate that. I think there's a full appreciation that something like this can happen at any time. Mm. The world can be shut down at any time. We could lose loved ones who we thought were healthy, young, would be with us for decades, to an unseen enemy, you know, and that's scary when you think about it. I mean, they define things that can happen to you over time that we've gotten, you know, used to. But then when something like this happens, and you have to even look at your loved one as a potential vector mm-hmm. for something like that. And therefore, you have to behave in a way to help protect the others. I mean, one of the things in the middle of the pandemic, my kids said to me, is, you know, they were limiting where they were going, et cetera, because I'm a type 1 diabetic and I have sickle cell.
Right.
And that touched me, right? I mean, they were altering their behavior. But I think people on campus did that, right, to protect teachers who were of a certain age. I think, you know, wearing masks, while some people may not have enjoyed doing that, I think they did it because they recognized while they may survive, an 18-year-old may survive having COVID, you know, their teacher, their 70-year-old faculty member may not. And so that was a reason to wear the mask. And so that selflessness, I think, was also important, and that appreciation of each other, you know, is something good that has come of it as well.
You know, even as you were speaking, and you talked about, the relative health vulnerabilities that you have. And, you know, we, of course, lost, you know, our beloved Patrick Ellis here. You know, my daughter had COVID, but she was young, and this was after the vaccination. My sister had it before the vaccination, and it was a horrifying thing for the family. COVID contributed to the death of my father last year. Mm-hmm. And so with just thinking how it has touched, you know, all of us, and as you said, you know, changed the world in good and bad ways, I think it's something for us to consider and constantly reflect on. Speaking of changing the world, the Helping Hands campaign here mm-hmm. is back 29 years, and once again, just an incredible effort. You know, you could argue that of all of the things that students do at Howard University, this is really one of the hallmarks of you know, truth and service.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm always humbled by our students' ability to provide service and what they're willing to do to uplift the community, and that giving freely of yourself, especially when some of those students, to be quite frank, are not in the most stable situations. You know, some of them don't have strong family support in terms of dollars, aren't sure they'll be here next semester, you know, aren't sure that they registered fully for this semester in terms of the payment plan they may have. And yet still, those students are going to show up. They're going to show up and support that Helping Hands campaign, as they did with Food to Feed, as they would do on Alternative Spring Break. I mean, it always humbles me that they do that. So we have a motto, I think, that's unique in higher ed, when we talk about truth and service. And as, you know, I like to say, students come here to get the truth. They get that in and outside of the classroom, but it comes alive as an education when they go out and provide service to others. And you know, the Helping Hands campaign is yet another aspect. I have to also say, I think it's also the other very unique thing about WHUR. There are radio stations that say they are part of the community and talk that up and talk about the community and provide educational things about the community. I think this radio station is unique in that it truly is a part of the community in every essence of that being. And a big part of that is epitomized by the service activity that it provides in the community. And I think that that's, you know, one of the, again, commendable things about, you know, institution such as WHUR that's a part of Howard University.
Well, I would say even as a kid listening to this radio station, that, you know, outside of, and allow me to, you know, toot our own horn for 30 seconds, outside of the outstanding music and the great voices that we have here, but they've always, the personalities here and the station itself has always been an extension of the community.
Yeah.
And I don't think I fully comprehended that, but my parents did. And so when you have, you know, this is another example of generational wealth, not in that the station has provided entertainment, information, and an extension of community for several generations. You know, dare I say, not just me, not just my parents, but also in some ways my parents' parents when the station first started, because it was such a new thing, and I'm not going to get into the HUR thing anymore. But you know,
yeah. But I will leave you with one thing. Yesterday, one of the unique things and stories that I'll take with the rest of my life was, you know, Secretary Austin, the Secretary of Defense, when he came in and, you know, we shook hands. It was my first time meeting him, and mm-hmm. he immediately said to me, "Oh, by the way, I enjoy your show, The Journey, because it comes on right after chapel." And then the Secretary of the Air Force, Secretary Kendall, was like, you know, what are you talking about? And so I said to him, you know, I do The Journey. And then Secretary Austin took over the conversation. And he said, well, you know, he has a radio station here at Howard, and you know, it's very important in the community. You can't live here in D.C. if you don't listen to WHUR. And I just thought to myself, I mean, this place is so unique in terms of its assets and what it provides.
Speaking of getting to the truth, one of the big news stories that we have seen over the past, you know, several weeks is this issue in Florida about the State Department of Education and, by extension, Governor DeSantis not wanting an advanced placement, an AP class in high school in African American history. I will say, quite frankly, being, you know, a graduate of an HBCU, my daughter being a graduate of HBCU, my parents graduating from HBCUs, and can we talk about that? You yourself, your entire educational career, I'm insulted. I am disturbed. Your thoughts about this and what this may portend as this issue continues to exacerbate.
Yeah, you know, I always say that Howard is the solution when I see these problems. So while these problems are vexing, I always greet them with the opportunity and the optimism. Within a week or two, you might have me back here because we're going to make a very important announcement around African-American studies. And I think it's going to definitely show again that we're invested in providing a solution. And that's the only way that we can combat these things. The politics of today and what's occurring in Florida is just a representation of a history that has been very difficult to deal with in this country. And so institutions like Howard University now have to double down on that, right? We have to educate more people around this issue. We have to elevate what African American studies means. And we have to make sure that people recognize that in every field, in every study in history, we have to emphasize and continue to make sure that the African American perspective is well represented. And that's Howard, you know, again, I think has a unique responsibility to lead in that area. And I think you'll see our investment in a couple of weeks that represents that, you know, doubling down on that, as it were.
Are you concerned the impact that something like this, you know, may have? I mean, certainly African-American history is, and let's be clear, that it is taught in high schools in Florida. But the AP, the advanced placement, is the one that is at issue. There are other advanced placement courses in European history and Asian history that is taught in high schools in Florida. Mm-hmm. But are you concerned that with the elimination of this advanced placement course, that it could have a detrimental effect on young minds coming out of Florida?
I think it can. There's no doubt about it, because I think that they are being cheated of an exposure, an experience that would enhance their not just their academic careers, but their I think, ability to navigate this world, to be quite honest. Having said that, I hope that the reaction to that would be recognizing that that doesn't exist there, that when some of these students do come from those high schools to institutions like a Howard, we will make an even bigger effort to make sure that we reorient them, as it were, around that opportunity. And I hope that other universities around the country would see that as an opportunity, you know, to give them that chance. You know, these things are disturbing, there's no doubt about it, but I have to underscore that, you know, the best enemy that you can have to fight is the enemy that you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think bringing some of this into an overt display, to some extent, is helpful. Because when we try to tell people that this exists, they think we're harping about something that, you know, isn't an issue. And then when people do something like this overtly, there's no denying it, right? Mm-hmm. And then we now have to make sure that we react appropriately and that we rally, you know, the support around what we must do in order to combat it. And I do think we'll be successful in doing that.
I almost forgot, we have a phone call. Jason, calling from Northwest Washington. Jason, thanks for calling. What's on your mind? Jason, are you there? Jason, give me a call back. You have a few minutes. The one of the other things that, and you've already spoken about this in the entire time that you've come on this program, you've been very transparent about the fact that this is an open campus, and you know that the dangers and evils that are out in the streets, you know, are always top of mind for you when it comes to the safety of the students. You know, we, D.C. and other cities, obviously, but D.C. is really undergoing a very, very difficult time regarding gun violence. What are you now doing to you know, shore up the protection of the university? That's a hard thing to do with an open campus, if you said before.
It's very difficult. We've done a few things. At the beginning of the academic year, in the fall, we had a safety day. We bought several uniform services to campus to talk to our students about safety. We rolled out a safety device that students can use to bring attention to a difficult situation they might be in. We had educational sessions around keeping yourself safe, traveling in groups, especially at night, trying to stay in areas that are well lit and avoiding, you know, alleys, etc., as you are moving from one area to another. In spite of all of that, there is going to be there will be things that we can't control. You know, a young man in the middle of the day today had his jacket, you know, stolen with other students around him. Fortunately, our force was able to apprehend the perpetrator and bring the jacket back to the student as well. But the fact of the matter is that element is there. I heard the mayor on a report today talking about the fact that she is more concerned about crime today than she was when the murders, the annual murders, were 400 and something murders in a city of 600,000 people. That's alarming. And the fact that she's concerned should make the rest of us concerned. So we have to double down on, one, the education. We have to double down on making sure our security force is expansive enough so our patrols are better and that we're keeping those areas secure. You know, we've been talking to the students even before the semester started. I was talking to the student leadership and even the reporters, the editors at the Hilltop, that one of my concerns this year was going to be public safety and whether we can do that. And I think we have to continue to do that. It's a nationwide issue. It's a citywide issue. And we are a microcosm of that city. But we have to take more measures to ensure. And right now, I do think our student body is rallying in the right way, you know, making sure that, like I say, they travel in groups. They mm-hmm. don't isolate themselves. They lock their items. We've got to patrol better in terms of our parking lots, et cetera. So thefts from cars and those things, we can keep those things down. Our crime statistics suggest that in terms of incidents on campus, that they're not trending the same way the city is trending. And I mm-hmm. attribute that to some of these measures around education and what Chief Lyles and his group are doing. But we're certainly at risk. We're not immune from it, and it's something that's going to be an ongoing challenge.
Yeah, Chief Lyles, in a conversation I had with him 3-4 weeks ago about the hiring fair, for example, trying to hire more officers, and I think sometimes that the visibility, I mean, community groups say we want to see them, and with the hiring of more officers, that higher visibility could in some way, shape, or form be a deterrent.
Yeah, it could be a deterrent, but we also have to recognize too that given what we've been through the past couple of years with policing, that we also want our students to feel comfortable, and we also don't want to over-police them or have them feel, you know, kind of militarized. So it's finding that right balance.
Dr. Wayne Frederick, it's good to see you. Happy New Year again, and we'll be talking again soon. When that next announcement about African American history comes up, please come back or, you know, give me a call. I'm very, very interested in hearing what the university is doing about that.
Absolutely. We look forward to being back, and thanks for having me as usual.
Absolutely. That is the Daily Drum for this Thursday, January 24th, 2023. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.